Now, you know, I've got to say, when many of us think of Christmas, you know, many of us have an idealized picture. I think a lot of people do. We have this idealized picture of what we hope our Christmas is going to be like. And we want the Hollywood version of Christmas with all the happy family that's around a beautiful table and a wonderful meal. And we've got stacks of presents over or underneath a beautifully decorated tree, because we think that Christmas is supposed to be the season of love and of joy and of hope and of peace. And that's what we long for. But unfortunately, for many of us, there's a significant gap between the Christmas that we desire and the Christmas that we seem to get, because we don't have the perfect family. Or in spite of all the efforts that we make and all the planning that we do, the fact is that things just don't seem to work out perfectly. Now let me share a little video that I think makes this point in a humorous way. It's a video of someone who wanted to have the perfect family Thanksgiving. And so he wanted to make this perfect video that showed just what the perfect family was like. And he planned it, but it didn't quite go the way that he expected.
And now, a Thanksgiving moment.
You know, this is the time of year when we realize what it is we have to be thankful for. Of course, I'm talking about Thanksgiving. I know it. Hang on a second. This is called suede, buddy, so you need to be careful with that lollipop. It's time to be with your kids and your nieces and nephews, and don't touch them. That's just going to egg them on. It's time when I remember all the warmth and love of conversations Guys, hey, guys, seriously.
Why don't you come help?
Don't even. But I know that I remember growing up. You know what, this is not going to work. Haley, I'm sorry, my back is killing me. This kid's about to break my knee off. This one is as ripe as it gets. We need a lot of wipes for that one. Well, that's right. And I remember the turkey and dressing, and you bet there was some cranberry sauce if Uncle Teddy had anything to do with it. And Uncle Floyd, I tell you what, Haley, you've got to get her out of here, because my headache is about to explode here.
Hey, seriously, Daryl, how about helping out this year?
Hey, I'll tell you what, why don't you go outside and wait for me? All right. And I remember sitting around and laughing as a family, and sweetie, I have got to have some room here to do this. I know, you know what, this is like a practical joke. This is terrible. Okay, I'm about to freak out here.
Daryl, should we put you at the kids' table since you're helping about as much as they are, or?
Hold on.
Don't point anymore. Do not point at me. Do not point.
So my hope is that you have a very blessed time and a relaxing Thanksgiving.
Now, I think we can relate to that, because we relate to this whole thing that we have these plans, but the holiday moments seldom seem to go the way that we planned. And in this video, it illustrates it in a humorous way, making fun of the little things that don't go as planned. But unfortunately for many, it's not the little things. I know for many that are here today, it's the real life Christmas is not what we hope for in big ways. For some, this is your first Christmas without a loved one who has passed away. For others, what started out as the dream of a loving family where you would be filled with joy instead has withered into the reality of a broken family filled with hostility and anger. Some of you can't pay your bills, let alone buy presents, and others are overwhelmed with difficult medical news. You know, as we look at this, do you know that this time of year is not only busy because of, the retail stop, stores and things like that, it's the busiest time also for psychologists and counselors. Because more than any other time of year, they flock, because I think the main reason is that they realize, here's my dream, here's my hope, this is the life that I wanted, and they realize that, boy, my life is so far from the dream that I wish that I had. And so we see this huge gap between the idealized holiday season, the idealized family that we would long for, and the pain or loneliness or brokenness that is our reality. Now, my goal isn't to be depressing. It isn't to remind you of all the things that are painful. My goal in saying all this is to realize that God calls us to a season of love and of joy and of peace. But it's one that is in the midst of. It's not idealized. It's one that's real. Because when we think of Christmas, what we've got to realize is that Christmas is a story of God entering into our story, of God literally entering into our brokenness and pain and bringing hope. He broke into the brokenness of our world to show us a love that was deeper than we had ever known. He gives us a joy that transcends the most difficult of circumstances, and he helps us to discover a peace that passes human understanding. Now, next Sunday, we're going to start really diving into the passage we read earlier, one of the great prophecies about Christmas, the great prophecy that declares who Jesus was, the wonderful counselor, mighty God, you know, everlasting Father. And we're going to dive into that. And we're going to see, it's in the passage again, let me put it up here, and that we read earlier. And we're going to dive into what this means. For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and the peace there will be no end. And it's a great passage, and we're going to dive into those different names next week and through Christmas Eve and Christmas morning. But before we dive into that, I wanted to take some time this morning and look at the passages that precede this great prophecy. Because right before this, we have some passages that tell us something about the environment that was there, that the setting, in a sense, that God would set to give his great gift. And then he tells us a little bit about the impact of that gift when it's given. But we're going to see as we look at this, is the first thing that I want you to realize is that when he gives this great prophecy, he also gives prophecy about what leads up to it. And it teaches us something about the silence of God in times of darkness. Now, when we look at this, what we've got to realize is that the Bible teaches, not only in this prophecy, but throughout, that before the coming of the Messiah, it was a time of darkness. It's a description that's given here in Isaiah chapter 8. If you have your Bibles, look here, starting in verse 19. And when they say to you, inquire of the mediums and the necromancers who chirp and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Should they inquire of the dead on behalf of the living? To the teaching and to the testimony. And if they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn. And so here's what he's saying. Here's how dark it's getting. He says to the people before Christ came, and we relate to this, people had gotten so lost that they're looking for some kind of direction, and they're looking to psychics. They're looking to mediums. They're looking for something spiritual, but they don't want to look to God, so instead they look to all these other spiritual sources, even psychics. And why? Because we see at the end of verse 20, because they have no dawn. They're in such great darkness that there's not even the beginning of the hint of the dawn. Verse 21 continues, they will pass through the land greatly distressed and hungry. And when they are hungry, they will be enraged and will speak contemptuously against their king and their God, and their faces turn their faces upward. And again, I look at this, and I know this was a prophecy about the time before the coming of Christ, but it's so relevant for our time as well. Here's what he's saying. Now, people are going to reject God, and as they reject God, their lives are going to become darker and darker. They're going to look to all these sources, and when those sources don't work, and when life falls apart even more, they're going to become distraught. They're going to become hungry. But as they sense of, when their sense of need grows, instead of looking to it and saying, boy, we've turned from God, we need to go back towards him, they're going to continue down the wrong path, and instead they'll become enraged, as it says, and speak contemptuously against their king and their God. They'll become angry at God. The God that they rejected, they'll turn around and become angry at him and become even more hostile towards him. Does that sound contemporary, like world today? Yeah, so, you know, it's prophecy about then, but it's true even now. And the more they reject God, the more they look to their own wisdom and to the wisdom of men for direction, and the more lost they become. Verse 22, they will look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness and the gloom of anguish, and they'll be thrust into darkness. So as it gets worse, they look not to God, but they look to the earth. They look for solutions of their own making. But what happens is they grow in distress and darkness and gloom of anguish. Now, if you know anything about the historical prophecy about, you know, Jesus and the things that happened right before, you'd know that that came true, that it was a very dark time, and the time leading up to Jesus' death. The Jewish people were impoverished financially and oppressed politically and confused spiritually. You know, there were spiritual leaders at the time, and they talked about God, but the things that they taught were really the wisdom of men. But it, you know, even though it was about God, it was really spiritual wisdom from their perspective. It wasn't trying to understand what God had revealed to them from his word. And for those who were trying to seek God, it seemed as if not only things were dark, but that God had grown silent. Again, look at verse now 16. It says, bind up the testimony, seal the teaching amongst the disciples. I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Now, I think that's significant because here you have one person saying, here's this environment, and in this environment, I'm trying to find God, and I'm trying to find him, but it feels as if God is hiding his face from me. It feels in the midst of the darkness that I cannot find God, that I'm looking for him, but I can't see his face. I'm calling out to him, but he seems silent. Now, here's the thing that is vital for us to realize. In that time, as in our day as well, this was all prophesied. This was prophesied about the coming of Messiah. And when we read this, it says, okay, God says, I'm going to give a gift. I'm going to enter human history. And all this is going to happen beforehand, all this pain and this brokenness. And what it tells us is that this is part of God's working. It isn't that God had forgotten about them or that God was silent or that God was distant. God was with them and pursuing them. And this was one of the ways that he was pursuing them. This was all part of the prophecy of how he would bring his blessing, how he would bring his provision. Yes, it seemed to them that God had forgotten them, but God had not forgotten them. And for those that are in those dark times, God hasn't forgotten you as well. Christmas is, again, God entering into our story, God entering into our suffering, entering into our darkness to bring light to our confusion, to bring joy to our brokenness, to bring a peace that passes human understanding. You see, God doesn't offer at Christmas. You know, when I think of all the Christmas movies, it's like, they're all, things are bad. And then there's some kind of Christmas magic, and it makes it all better. You got to find the magic candle or the magic dust, and it makes it all better. God doesn't offer that. Jesus Christ isn't the magic candle or the magic dust to somehow change things. What he offers is he offers a relationship with him, not that changes our circumstances, but that changes us so that we'll be able to find peace and joy and love of Christmas no matter what the circumstances. But then we still have to ask, why would God allow these dark times? Why is it part of this great prophecy of the wonderful coming of Jesus? Do we have right before it this prophecy of darkness, of silence, of silent nights? Well, I think there's a reason. See, there is a reason that we can see here and even in understanding how God arranged the setting of the giving of his gift. See, when we read this prophecy of Isaiah 8, one thing that stands out more than any other is this idea of darkness. They're in darkness. They're confused. And, they're distressed. And we have to ask, why again would God allow this? Well, see, he allowed it, in a sense, to teach us something about the gift. That there's something that we can learn about the setting of how a gift is given. If a gift is given in a certain way, it draws attention to the gift. Let me explain this. We know this at Christmas time. Many of you have been out, you've been out shopping, and you've been buying presents, and if you have a really nice present, what do? You take it and you wrap it. You put it in a certain setting. You wrap the gift and you put really nice wrapping on it and you put it under the tree because there's a certain setting that makes the giving of the gift even more wonderful. And, and we say, well, that's important. And some of the men say, well, that's not important to me. It's, some of us men really don't know how to do that. And, I have to say at times I've brought Sandy's present and it's like, okay, well, I bought it on the web and it came and it was wrapped in a brown package and it's all wrapped and she doesn't know what it is. I can put it under the tree and we're all there and we're great. And I won't tell you if I've really done that, but please don't ask Sandy. A lot of us men, we don't think of presentation. How many men even know how to make a bow? I feel good if I tape one on and so we'd say, well, isn't that important? But you know what? Even for us men, it is. If it's a really special gift, when you give that gift, you think of the way that you give it. Let me illustrate it. Almost every married man here has given a really, really special gift that you gave a lot of thought to on how you gave it. The most special of gift, one of the most expensive gifts you've ever given, that engagement ring. You see, I doubt if there were many men here who, you went out, you made the decision to ask her to marry you, and you save the money, you go out and you buy the engagement ring, and then you just go home from the store, and you just go up to her and you say, you know what, I got this for you, here's, if you want to marry me, here it is. No, we didn't do it that way, did we? No, you thought about it. You surprised her. I mean, let me tell you about us. I mean, we were living in South Florida at the time. And so I did this whole surprise. You know, there was this, I was in West Palm Beach, and there was this place in Palm Beach, you know, this outdoor mall. And I thought, boy, that'd be the ideal place to go. And I'd scouted this all out. There's this little water fountain that's out there in this outdoor mall. It's a two-story outdoor mall. And so I went, I got this little teddy bear dressed as a bride, and I put the wedding ring on the necklace of the teddy bear. And I went and I got three giant helium balloons. I mean, these things were, I mean, I could barely fit them in my car. And I got my sisters to help me, and so they were upstairs in this mall with the teddy bear and the helium balloons. And I took Sandy, you know, we were late at night, and she had no idea this was coming. In fact, you know, I told her that it was going to be a while. She was mad at me for running away from marriage. And so we're walking around, and I said, oh, there's this fountain, and there's a little bottle in the fountain. I said, well, let's look at that bottle. And we take it out, and so there's a note in there. And she's like, oh, leave it alone. It's not for us. And I said, no, we should look at it. And I'm nervous. And so I take the cork out with my teeth. And she's, oh, that's gross. You know, and it was all working great, except a little water got on the note. So she's trying to open it up and read it. And she's like, dear, you know, just, you know, so what's it say? There's Sandra. Will you marry me? And she's like, no. And then we look up, and my sisters are up there, and they let the balloons down with the little teddy bear, and a gust of wind came and took the teddy bear away. And you know, I was worried about that, but that didn't happen. You know, it came down, and you know, and I planned this all out. And you say, you all did that? Yeah, I did, because I have a beautiful wife, married to now 25 years. We just celebrated our anniversary. And she was worth it. And I'm thankful, because you look at that, when you have that special gift, you think about the context of the giving of that gift. Now you say, well, my God, that's all bright and happy. You know, that's wonderful, but all this isn't bright and happy. This isn't like the ring and the balloon. This is like dark. Now, why in the world would we have this? Well, for starters, we need to remember that it's, again, the most valuable gift of all time, and so God is very concerned about how he would give that gift. And there's an important principle to remember here, that the brightest light, a light shines brightest when it sets against deep darkness. It's a really something that we understand. You know, again, if you think of, you know, I think of shopping, and when, you know, buy an engagement ring, if you go to a jewelry store, you know, what's interesting is when they display the jewelry, they take the brightness of jewelry, of gold, of diamonds, or of jewels, and they set it usually against darkness. Against, you know, in a black velvet oftentimes, because it draws out the color. Now, that's something that we understand in real time here. Now, here's what God is saying. He says, I want you to understand this message, but to understand it, I'm going to allow things to become dark, because when things come dark, you'll appreciate the need for light. And so he said to the people then, okay, as you continue to live in sin, the further that you get in sin, you know, the further you get there, it's only going to get worse and worse. There's brokenness upon brokenness, and even to the point where people get so angry and they don't turn to God, but they start cursing God, the God that they've been ignoring. But on the other hand, you know, when we come and we submit to God, what happens is that as we submit to him, the blessings of that build as well. See, but what happened is he's saying, no, here's, I'm going to let this go. I'm going to let people that if they're going to wander away from God, I'm going to let that happen. And as it grows darker and darker, people will become more aware of the need. And so when the light shows up, it will be clear. Paul says this in Romans. Do you not know that if you present yourself to anyone as obedient slaves, you are the slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or obedience, which leads to righteousness? And he's saying, you know, here's what you've got to realize is that when you make these bad decisions, you become more and more broken. We become slaves, literally, to that sin, so that we can't escape it. And then God will oftentimes allow us to go so deep in that, and then he'll step into our lives at the time that we need him, because we're so desperate we realize that we need him. Romans 5 says this, for while we were still sinners, at the right time Christ died for us. And that's often what we see, that in our own lives, that, you know, that God intervenes at the right time. I've talked to numerous people over my life, you know, that are like, man, I wish I was saved in an early state. I wish I didn't make these mistakes. I wish I didn't do this. I regret all these decisions that I've made. But then when you talk to them, you realize that even while I was running away from God, God was pursuing me. And oftentimes it was those times that I was rejecting God and totally running away from him, I became aware of my need and of my brokenness. And at the right time, God came. When things became totally dark, that's when the light showed up, and that's when I could recognize it. So I want to encourage you here that there are some people that, number one, there might be some people here that you're like, I'm not sure why I'm here today. I don't belong. God would never accept me. Listen, you are not, there's no way in the world you're too far away from God. That you might think, you know all the things that I've done. God may have allowed you to go deep into that darkness because now he wants to show you the light. And the message of grace is always there. We have people in our own lives that we look at and we say, well, that person, man, their heart is so hard. They have turned so far away from God, I can't imagine that they'd ever believe. But I want to again remind you that God's miracle is one of changing hearts. And oftentimes God's way of leading people towards himself, like the prodigal son, it isn't trying to hold us there. It's allowing us to wander away and reject him, because then we become aware of our need and that we see the light. We embrace it when it comes and hits us. In fact, sometimes it's the good people, the people that are religious, that have the hardest time coming to know Christ. Billy Graham once talked about how it's possible to become inoculated against religion. You know, you get just enough of, or Christianity, you get just enough of it that you don't ever get the real thing. And there are people that are religious and they're good and they try hard and they think that they don't need God. And a lot of times it's harder for them to come to Christ than the people whose lives become broken. And I want to encourage you here that you might be in a season of brokenness, but that season of brokenness isn't God being absent. It may be God pursuing you. It may be God drawing you to himself and say, I want to give you the ultimate blessings, but I'm going to allow the season of darkness and brokenness to come, because only then will you see your need for the light. And not only do we see that need, but it not only magnifies our need, but then it also magnifies our appreciation for that gift, for the light when we find it. You know, because the thing is that not only do I see the need, but then when I find it, you know, I realize that I was blind and now I'm found. I was broken. You know, ultimately, it's people that are filled with hatred when they truly come to Christ, they are changed and they know it, and everyone around them know it. When a person is filled with anger, and when peace and love come into the heart, everybody sees it. When somebody's their life is the pursuit of pleasure and they're truly changed, everyone can see it. I love what Jesus even says about this in Luke chapter 7. He says, therefore I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much, but who is forgiven little loves little. You know, the fact of the matter is none of us are forgiven little. All of us are forgiven much. But a lot of times if I never went through that period of darkness, I wouldn't have realized how much I really was forgiven. And so sometimes God allows that period because it not only helps us to see our need, but it helps us to be overwhelmed with gratitude for what God has done in our lives. Because when we see this, we see that, yes, God shows us the need, but even seeing the need, it shows us the impact of the gift when it's given. And as we look at chapter 9 now, it starts off in chapter 9, and it talks about, okay, now here was the need, but here's the solution. And starts in verse 1 of chapter 9. There'll be no gloom for those who are in anguish, for in the former times he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter times, he made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond Judah, and Galilee of the nations. Basically saying, you know, before it was in gloom, but now we're going to take you from gloom and despair to glory. There's no longer a land of anguish. That's going to be healed. And how does he do that? Look at verse 2, if you have your Bibles. The people who walked in darkness will have seen a great light. For those who dwell in a land of deep darkness, on them a light is shone. First of all, it says, okay, the problem is that we are in darkness. And the darkness is now going to be redeemed because there's a gift of a great light. A great light that now reveals the way, that gives us hope. See, what we realize is that a lot of times, again, in the darkness, as we've talked about, that's when we become aware of the need. But suddenly we become so aware of that need that we continue to go in darkness and we continue, you know, issue after issue, trying to be able to find the way, and we get more and more lost. And sometimes God allows that to happen because he says, I want you to become aware of the need. I want you to realize that you're lost in darkness and you need a light that isn't there. In fact, there's so much in Scripture that talks about this. The idea that God uses things to prepare us to see Jesus Christ. Look what Paul says in Galatians. Now, before faith came, we were held captive under the law, imprisoned until the coming faith would be revealed. So then the law was our guardian until Christ came, in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. For in Christ, you are all sons of God through faith. And what he's saying is this. You know, that even the purpose of the law, the purpose of religion, was to show us limitations. It wasn't to try to be good and somehow if we can find light and figure out our own way. Even the purpose of religion was to show us we couldn't do it. We couldn't keep the rules. But we had to find a light that was not from our own goodness, our own effort, our own solution, our own wisdom, but we had to find a light that was from above. Paul talks about this in Romans 3. But now the righteousness of God has been made manifest apart from the law, though the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ is for all who believe, for there's no distinction, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. So the beautiful thing is that we have a light that's there, that's offered to us, that isn't about us being good. It isn't about us trying harder. It isn't about our own wisdom. It's about us admitting our need and seeking that light who comes and gives us what we could not have on our own. He not only gives us the light, but he also gives us joy. In the midst of a culture then and now that are lost in gloom and despair, he gives us a transcendent joy. Look at verse 3. You have multiplied the nation and have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, and they're glad when they divide the spoil. It's a transcendent joy that doesn't depend on circumstances. See, here's what we have to realize. A lot of times when we think of joy, we confuse the idea of joy with the idea of happiness. In the Bible, when it uses these words, they're very, very different ideas. See, for us in the English language, they're often very similar. See, biblically, when the Bible talks about it, the idea of happiness is something that is dependent upon circumstances. And so it's this idea that, you know, when we think of joy to the world and, you know, Merry Christmas and joy, and the way we often use it, we're talking about biblical happiness, something that we are happy because circumstances are good. So if everything is going well, if your family's together and everyone is healthy, if everyone's getting along, if you have the money to buy presents for under the tree, then you can have a Merry Christmas. But for everyone else, you know, unless you find the magic candle or the magic dust to somehow magically change your circumstances, where do you find Christmas joy? See, God's promise is not, if you follow me, I'm going to fix your circumstances. That I'm going to give you the magic candle, I'm going to give you the magic dust, I'm going to provide whatever magic that's going to be there to make you happy. I'm going to send Santa to come and grant your wishes. And no, he does not make a promise to make us happy, nor does he promise in any way to change his circumstances. See, he doesn't say, I'm going to change your circumstances and give you happiness. What he does promise us is that he promises to give us a joy that transcends the circumstances. There are many here this morning that I realize that this Christmas season will be a difficult season. You have lost a loved one, and you can't imagine what Christmas is going to be like without them. Or your marriage is at the breaking point, or maybe it has already broken. And suddenly you're living with the reality of division that, you know, that breaks your heart. Or you've lost a job and you're worried about paying the bills. Or you know that you're going to spend time with that family and you know it's going to bring back all those painful memories of your past. Or you're facing chemo as the Christmas present and you're like, man, what a great Christmas this is going to be. And you say, how can I find joy? Well, you can't find happiness in that, but you can find joy. Because what we're talking about biblically is a joy that transcends happiness. And God says that he gives us the ability to find joy in the midst of the hardest and most painful times. It's what Paul talks about in Philippians 4 when he says that we can find a peace that passes understanding. That people around us, they don't understand. It doesn't make sense. Look at again in verse 4 what he says here. It says, they will rejoice before you as in the joy of the harvest. It's not that you rejoice because the harvest has come. It's you rejoice as if the harvest has come. We have a joy that is there that is as if things are good. But it's not dependent on things being good. See, God doesn't always change everything in the background. He doesn't promise to change the setting of our lives. And oftentimes, the background of our Christmas still has times of darkness. But Christmas brings the gift of God's light into that darkness. He doesn't always destroy the elements of emptiness in our life, but he brings joy into the emptiness, a joy that doesn't undo the circumstances, but that always has the power to transcend the circumstances. What a great promise that he brings. We're going to talk about that even more next week, because that's so much in the promise of Isaiah 9:6. But not only does he bring that joy, not only does he bring light, he brings liberation. Again, look at verse 4. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, have been broken on the day of Midian. Now, what's that mean? He says here, I'm going to bring liberation, specific liberation from bondage and freedom to pursue the blessed life. Now, because if you go back and you read that, what do you read in the beginning? What was the description of the darkness? They're rejecting God, but they continue to go down the same path. You continue to reject God more. You continue to do these paths, try these strategies that have failed in the past, and people grow in their frustration and brokenness. Why? Because the Bible talks about sin in terms of slavery. The Bible talks about sin in terms of saying when we choose sin, we actually become enslaved to it. We become empowered by it. You know, I talk to people all the time who think, you know, the Christians are the ones that are hindered, that are enslaved, that have restrictions. And they'll look at that and say, well, you're a Christian. You can't do this. You know, if you're not married, you can't have sex before you're married. And you can't go get drunk. And you can't do, you know, it's all these rules. And that's what Christianity is. And that's what people often perceive that to be. You know, poor Christians are all slaved. But here's what you need to realize. That's not at all the case. The fact of the matter is that I don't do certain things not because I can't, because I don't want to. And I can look at people who are doing all those things and I can say, you're doing that because you have to. So what do you mean? Well, here, you know, if you've got somebody that's drinking, if somebody that's enslaved to any sin, whatever sin it would be, I said, can you go out and not do it for 10 days? And usually whatever sin, it's like, I can't give that up for 10 days. We're enslaved to those things. We think that we're in freedom, but in reality, we're not. It's Christ that brings freedom. And I look at this and I say, I don't do those things because I don't have to. And I realize that they've never satisfied me. So why would I continue to throw my life away? Why would I continue to pursue, you know, immorality and outside of marriage when it destroys what is so wonderful? Why would I go out and get drunk when I have freedom and enjoyment beyond that when I'm sober? Why would I go do stupid things like that? I'm free not to. See, Christianity brings us a liberation from bondage, and it frees us to pursue the blessed life that we've been talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. It frees us up to be able to make the decisions that we couldn't do on our own. See, let's even think about it in terms of light, because remember, the first promise is light, and it's related to that. See, before we were in darkness, and in darkness, what happens? When you're lost in darkness, you think that the path that you're choosing is the best path. We're in a sense enslaved to that because we don't know better. And the light suddenly opens it up and helps us to see. The light gives us freedom. But here's what we need to realize. I can look at this and my choices have failed in the past. And suddenly I see light. But you know what? Light isn't always something welcome. Look what John says about this in John 3. And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world and the people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out and gone. And here's what it's saying. Yes, light shows the way. It shows the life that we were designed for. It shows the blessed life, the things that will actually work. And it's wonderful and it's empowering, but it's also terrifying and convicting. Because while it shows us the right way, it also reveals all the wrong decisions that we've made and that we're still making. It reveals that our own fault, that I'm at fault for the mess that I'm in. It's not somebody else's fault, it's my fault for my decisions. And you know what? Most of us are too proud to really admit those failures, to take ownership. So what happens is that I get angry at the person that exposes me, the person that's shown the light. Or I sit there and I say, well, I know that my life is a mess, but you know what? This is all I know. This is all I know. This is the only way that I really believe that ultimately, even though it's never fulfilled in the past, I think it's going to bring me happiness. And so these same sins that we've done in the past continue to control me because it's the only path that I know. And the light comes and exposes the lie of that, but I'm afraid to be able to admit that. I'm afraid to give up on it. And so again, it terrifies us. It terrifies us to give up that dependency on the sins that we think that we need. But we need to realize that their only hope is the light. Our only hope is to admit that, God, I've made these decisions. They haven't worked in the past, and I need you to come and to change me. I need to submit to you. I need to recognize that the fact that God came in humanity means that Jesus Christ is God, and he deserves my loyalty. He deserves my worship, that he's the one that designed me, and it's only when I follow him that will my life work the way it's designed. See, our brokenness will not be healed until it's fully admitted, until we embrace the love and gift of Jesus Christ. And this only happens as a gift of grace. It's not something we do. It's not something that we get by our own wisdom. It's not something that we can do on our own. In fact, if you look at verse 5 there, it says, "For every boot of the trampling warrior may in battle turmoil, and every garment be rolled in blood and be turned into fuel as fire." Now here's what it's saying with that. This is a battle. We're sitting there saying, how do I get out of the gloom? How do I get out of the darkness? How do I find life? It's a battle. But it's a battle that we are not meant to fight. Because it describes as a battle and says, here's how you win the battle. "For unto you a child is born, unto you a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. He will win the battle." See, Christianity is a message of God coming into our life, but it's also a call for us to surrender to that gift of grace that he's given us. Let me close with a little illustration. We have a men's study and we ran across this a couple weeks ago. And let me just close, because I think it says so many of this so well. It's Victor Hugo, who's a French novelist, was best known for Les Miserables. And he writes that one day he was sitting in his study and he heard a tapping against his window. He got up and he saw that there was a lone bee trapped inside of study, and it was flinging itself against the glass in an attempt to escape. He saw the garden there and it was trying to get there. And on the floor beneath, he saw a dozen dead bees that had been doing the same thing. And it ultimately ran out of energy and were there on the floor dead. So he lifted up a napkin from the table and he attempted to capture the bee and to try to grab it and to be able to guide it towards the open window. And it became aware of that. It frantically began to plunge this way and that way, trying to escape him. Eventually, he was able to grasp the bee gently and slip it through the window, and then it was free into the garden. And Hugo just reflected on this, and he saw the similarity between his relationship with the bee and God's relationship with man. He says, "The bee is trapped in a predicament beyond its understanding, and it longed to be free. To that end, it was working with all the energy it could." But Hugo had this broader perspective, and he could see that the bee was beating its head against the window, and what it thought was true wasn't true, and it would continue to fail until it led to his death. Its only path was for this outside influence to grab it. But that outside influence was scary. It was terrifying. It had revealed a need. It meant surrendering. But only when he submitted to that and was allowed to be grabbed could he be brought to freedom and to enjoy the freedom that he was designed for. Only then would he discover life. My friends, that's exactly the story here. That we are trapped, that we are lost, that our predicament is dire apart from Christ. But Jesus Christ came. He came into our world, and now he comes and he wants to grab us and he wants to take us. And that's scary. It's terrifying. It's terrifying to submit. It's terrifying to give up that freedom. But you know what? Every time we've hit that window, it's never worked before and it's never going to work again. Our only hope is to let God take us in his hands and to bring us to the freedom that we can have in Jesus Christ, to receive the gift that is given as a gift of grace. My friends, if you're here today, I want to encourage you, if you don't have that relationship with Christ, Christmas is about God entering into human history so that we can know him. And if you're here today, I hope that you will embrace that call, that you will ask him in your heart, that you will say, "God, I recognize the need. I ask you to forgive me." For all of us, we need to realize the story of Christmas is a wonderful story, but it's not this idealized story. It's a real story of God entering in human history in the midst of darkness, of times that there's dark nights where God seems silent, and we still experience that. That's still what many of us will experience even this Christmas. And I want to encourage you that as you look at this Christmas, to realize, don't just look at the glitz and glitter. but look at even the setting of this gift. As we look at the wonder of the gift over the next couple weeks, remember the setting and realize that God gave his gift into the darkness of night. God literally entered into that darkness with us so that he brings us hope, so that he brings us a light in the midst of our darkness and confusion, that he brings us joy that transcends circumstances, that he brings us freedom from sins that would control us as we accept his free gift of grace.